The chef, Claudia Lawrence, went missing in 2009, and in Woman's Hour at 10, her father, Peter, and her best friend, Susie Cooper, talked to Jane Garvey. Call the Midwife writer, Heidi Thomas, discusses healthcare issues raised by the hit TV series. The pianist, Valentina Lisitsa, has had 46 million hits on YouTube, and she'll be playing live in the Woman's Hour studio. First, our book of the week, The Last Days of Detroit by the journalist Mark Benelli. Moving back to the Detroit after 16 years away, Benelli discovers in intimate detail how the city has become a monument to urban failure.
One afternoon, to get a better sense of the state of the city beyond the confines of the auto show, I met up with John Carlisle, the proprietor of the marvelous Detroit blog, on which he filed dispatches from some of the least visited corners of the city. That afternoon, we drove alongside snow-covered plains where houses once stood, what locals had begun calling the urban prairie, and crept around the perimeter of General Motors' immense Fisher Body Plant, closed since 1984, its six floors of broken windows, hundreds of them, entire blocks of them, giving the place an odd beauty, like a dried-out beehive. At the vacant lot where Motown's headquarters had been left abandoned for years, we observed a moment of silent contemplation, Carlisle recalling the time before the demolition when he'd snuck inside and stumbled across Marvin Gaye's old desk, with love notes to Gaye's wife still in one of the drawers. Finally, back downtown, we parked in front of the Metropolitan Building, a 15-story neo-Gothic office tower opened in 1924. It was a weekday afternoon, but the street was completely deserted. A block away, I could see Woodward Avenue, Detroit's main thoroughfare. The Metropolitan, once the center of the jewelry trade in Detroit, housed a number of jewelry manufacturers and wholesalers, but it had been empty since 1977. Someone had painted a garish football mural on the ground floor, and a filthy brown teddy bear had been tied to a street sign.
"Memorial," Carlisle said. "Someone was shot here."
Walking quickly to one of the building's doors, Carlisle turned the knob and was surprised to find it unlocked. Then he noticed a woman behind the counter at a carryout place across the street, eyeing us. "Here, pretend I'm taking your picture," he said, posing me next to the memorial bear. He snapped a few shots until the woman turned away. Then we slipped inside the building, and Carlisle switched on his flashlight. We began climbing the stairs. It was dark, and the wires dangling from the ceiling looked eerie and web-like. On one of the doors, someone had written, "If you want to die..." I paused and tried to make out the rest of the sentence, but it was illegible. Carlisle stopped on the flight above me and hissed, "What's wrong? You hear someone?" Eventually, we made it to the top floor. A couple of rusty radiators had been dragged to the center of the room and abandoned. "Crackheads always try to take them for scrap, but then realize they're too heavy," Carlisle said. He led me out to the snow-covered roof. We blinked in the bright daylight, staring up at what we'd come to see. The building's beautiful stone facade, a carved knight's helmet topping a coat of arms, an ornate fleur-de-lis garlanding each window. Carlisle snapped a few pictures. He had started photographing Detroit's ruins several years earlier. In his explorations, he had come across homeless encampments, drug addicts getting high, a couple having sex. In another building, eight cops showed up with their guns drawn. After realizing Carlisle had only a camera, they let him go. There was nothing for him to steal, anyway, even if he had been a thief. "This city is like a living museum," Carlisle said. "A museum of neglect." We moved over to the parapet of the roof, crenellated like the top of some fortress, and gazed out at the city skyline. "That building is empty," Carlisle said, pointing to the nearest skyscraper. He shifted his finger to the left. "So is that one. And that one, too." In 1995, a Chilean photographer, Camilo José Vergara, had cheekily proposed allowing a cluster of buildings in downtown Detroit to molder and become an American Acropolis. Dismissed by many as a smirking ivory tower provocateur, Vergara turns out to have been a prophet. Standing in calf-deep snow, my hands thrust deep in my coat pockets, staring out at this wintry scene of ruin, I had to admit, I didn't really feel sadness or anger, or much of anything. Depressingly, perhaps, it all just felt normal. For people of my generation and younger, growing up in the Detroit area meant growing up with a constant reminder of the best having ended a long time ago. We held no other concept of Detroit but as a shell of its former self. Our parents could mourn what it used to be and tell us stories about the wonderful downtown department stores and the heyday of Motown and muscle cars. But for us, those stories existed as pure fable. It was like being told about an uncle who died before you were born. What a terrific guy he'd been. If only you had the chance to meet him, see how handsome he looks in these old pictures. Would my kids one day grow up thinking the same thoughts about America as a whole? About my ponderous tales of Cold War victories and dot-com booms? It was easy to let your imagination drift in melodramatic courses. A malaise spreading through the rest of the country, a creeping sense of dread that, after spending the past 8 years doing absolutely everything wrong, this time we really had reached the inevitable end of our particular empire. All of this had the effect of making Detroit, for the first time in my life, feel less like a crazy anomaly and more like a leading indicator. I found myself fleetingly wondering if Detroit, in the end, might reclaim its old title after all. Not the Motor City, but the City of Tomorrow. John said we should go. I squinted out over the ledge one last time. The icy wind was almost harsh enough to make you cry. And Detroit, from up here, looked like it went on forever. My own return to the city began at the edge of downtown, in the Eastern Market neighborhood. Though best known for its weekly farmers market, Eastern Market remained primarily a distribution hub for wholesale food, produce, imported dry goods, meat from several working slaughterhouses. I'd made regular deliveries to Eastern Market for my dad as a teenager, and when I pulled my rental car onto Service Street, which ran behind the building housing my new apartment, I realized I'd navigated this very alley many times before, years earlier, in one of my father's knife delivery vans, dropping off, as I recalled, newly sharpened meat grinder blades, which resembled little metal starfish and spun around in the grinder's gullets. Butcher and Packer, a supplier of restaurants and meat markets, was still in business, just down the block from my new place. A key component of the Butcher and Packer inventory had been an assortment of pre-mixed spices for seasoning sausages. 20 years later, I could immediately conjure the pungent, curried funk of the place. I remembered Service Street as an unremarkable back alley, but once I started living there, pulling onto the red brick cobblestone always felt like entering a secret world. Doors to several of the buildings had been painted vivid colors, and a pair of old kitchen sinks had been converted into window boxes. There were landscape flower beds, wind chimes hanging from a post, a fire pit at the rear of a dirt parking lot. My downstairs neighbor, Lass, a personal chef, could often be heard shouting, "Shiva, be still, girl!" Shiva was a pit bull given to loud barking. But Lass himself struck me as an incongruous pit bull owner, gentle-voiced, with a round baby face, except for the traces of gray stubble, and such a mellow demeanor you might take him for a transplant from Laguna Beach, though he'd been born and raised in the city. Lass was just one of an appealing mix of residents. Among them, a jazz drummer, a clothing designer, the founder of the Detroit chapter of the Black Panthers, several DJs and artists, including a creator of art neckties. And during occasional visits from Amsterdam, John Sinclair, the poet and former manager of the MC5, famously busted in 1969 for possession of 2 joints and sentenced to 10 years in prison. It also turned out that Detroit techno, a seminal early genre of electronic dance music, had basically been invented on Service Street. This had been back in the 80s by the so-called Belleville Three, high school classmates Derek May, Juan Atkins, and Kevin Saunderson, who had all had recording studios on the block. I would still occasionally see May, whose record label office remained on Service Street, driving down the alley in his blue convertible BMW when he wasn't DJing at some club in Tokyo or Rotterdam, which is how he still spent most weekends. My favorite new neighbors were Steve and Dorota Coy, young artists who had met and married in Hawaii, and then, in what might be an unprecedented move in the history of human migration, decided to relocate to Detroit. The first night we hung out, Steve told me, "This is the last frontier in the country. What else is left? There's Hawaii, there's Alaska, and there's Detroit." It made a strange kind of sense, although we were both very drunk. Dorota, born in Poland, and Steve tagged abandoned buildings with stencils promoting their non-existent corporation, the Hygienic Dress League. Often they depicted themselves in their artwork, wearing gas masks and carrying machine guns or mysterious briefcases. In real life, they never went anywhere without their tiny dog, Bob, often carted around by Steve in a shoulder bag. They were subletting an entire floor of an old furniture warehouse, about 3,000 square feet of raw studio space, for $250 a month. Another neighbor, Hollis Wood, a stocky guy with a ponytail, had a variety of money-making gigs, or hustles, as he liked to say. Detroit was the sort of place where even the people who held down a real job also had a hustle going. Hollis's hustles included, but were not limited to, promoting blues concerts, starting his own t-shirt company, and plotting the opening of a marijuana dispensary. Despite the ponytail, Hollis evinced none of the mellow grooviness such a hairstyle choice generally implied. He spoke with a loud, sandpapery voice and had a habit of fixing you right in the middle of conversation with a highly scrutinizing, cold-blooded stare, giving the impression that he might at any moment begin shouting for no reason or else challenge you to a fist fight. He lived in a windowless cinder block bunker on the very corner of the alley, adjacent to a garage that I'd always taken for a chop shop, but that apparently was being rented by a muscle car enthusiast with a regular day job. The first time we met, Hollis told me, "When I moved here 5 years ago, I couldn't walk my dog without carrying my gun with me." Leaning forward, he warned, "This is not a block where you can be timid." He went on, "If you hear any noise or commotion, you need to come down and see what's going on and help out, because that's the only way we keep this street the way it is." He took a step closer. "This is where we live," he pronounced carefully. "If you see someone pissing on that wall over there, or trying to break into a car, you need to chase them down." I nodded. Of course I would chase thieves. It was Detroit. I just hope people, it'll never happen to you. Yes, yeah. I can hear the farmer. He said, "Let's get out of here."
The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by John Schwab. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. And tomorrow, with crime the abiding concern of most Detroiters, Benelli attends a gun class. Claudia Lawrence went missing in 2009. Her father Peter and her friend Susie Cooper talked to Jane Garvey in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes here on BBC Radio 4. And The Call of the Midwife writer Heidi Thomas discusses the hit TV series.
An ex-art student from Brixton has turned himself into a bizarre, self-constructed freak.
A young British Asian girl growing up in suburbia, I thought I was alone in my fascination. Since then, I've been finding out how wrong I was.
Samira Ahmed explores the impact of David Bowie on British Asian teenagers.
There was something very exciting and inspiring. To see an artist positively choosing to play with identity.
I Dressed Ziggy Stardust on Saturday morning at 10:30 on BBC Radio 4.